everybody. Welcome to episode 616 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Valiant Sunday episode, and we're continuing the chronology with our look at Harbinger. We're up to issue 3, which is written by Joshua Dysart. We have art by Kari Evans with Louis LaRosa. Color art is by Ian Hannon with Moose Bauman. Letters are by Rob Steen. And after the frenetic pace of issue 2, this slows us down a little bit, and it gives us our first peek inside Harada's realm, if you will, his secret school for training Psyots. So I think at this point, the third issue is where I really started to see some parallels with the previous iteration of Harbinger. Before that, it had been quite different. But at the same time, I feel like I kind of wish I'd never read the 90s Harbinger, because I'm curious how I would have reacted to seeing this, right? I couldn't help but, you know, you hear the name Toyo Harada. If you've read the 90s stuff, you know he's quote-unquote the bad guy. But I'm wondering if, as somebody, as a new reader comes in and reads this and sees this, and do they believe the things that Toyo Harada is saying? Or do they recognize that he's got ulterior motives and perhaps he's not as benevolent as he seems? So it's an interesting exercise to think about. And I don't know, I guess maybe I'll reach out on the Valiant Fans forums and see if anybody there that didn't read the 90s stuff read this and what their take on Harada was. What are your thoughts about that, Jesse?
Well, in the 90s, by the time we were at issue number 3, we were in outer space dealing with spider aliens. So it was much faster. I mean, you had the Zero issue and you had issue 1, where there was a lot of the Harbinger Foundation explained briefly, but it wasn't as in-depth as what we got here. A lot of what we knew about Toyo Harada, we had first been introduced to him in Solar Man of the Atom issue number 3, where he pretty much comes straight out and tells you, hey, this is my game and this is who I am. And you already know before even Harbinger even began, before Harbinger was even released as a title, kind of what was coming. Now fast forward, 2012, and here you are with, the newer, reiteration of the series. You're supposed to, I guess, know he's the bad guy, but at the same time, I mean, if you're a blank slate coming to this, this is all coming in and there's no way to know. I mean, you could be viewing him as, a Japanese Professor Xavier. It's hard to say at this point, how I might have otherwise felt, had I not read that, the 90s version. I do think that the pacing was right in, giving 3 issues, to kind of span out, to this point, to where you kind of really are, introduced to a whole cast of characters in the Harbinger Foundation, and slowly with each Renegade, that is released.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, there's something about Toyo, regardless of anything overt, where I think even if I was coming into it new, I mean, I'm not that trusting of a person anyway, and the whole too good to be true kind of thing. So I think right away, he may have like been on my radar, like, well, I don't know if I believe everything this guy's telling me, right? Like, I don't know. He seems, and then, you know, there's a part of me that's always going to be pretty skeptical and suspicious about somebody that has that much power, right? Just absolute power, or what do they say? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So there's that whole aspect of it as well. So, all right, well, let's go ahead and dive into the kind of synopsis for the issue here. As I said, if you joined me last week when I covered 2, it was really breakneck pacing. It started off with issue 1, pretty fast pace. I think issue 2 really accelerated that pacing. And then issue 3, the one we're going to talk about tonight, really kind of slows that down a little bit. But issue 3 does pick up right where issue 2 left off. It's the van that Peter was picked up in, heading to downtown Pittsburgh to the Harada Global Conglomerates building. And once they get there, Pete notices all the guards with guns, and he's like, more jackasses with guns. It's not, you know, what he expected. And he's saying, why would people like us need guns? And he's told, well, you know, in the event that there is an attack, we can defend ourselves without having to expose our powers. It's in hiding. It's behind closed doors. It's Harada trying to manipulate and make sure that he's not found out. So, you know, clearly he's put a lot of thought into this. Clearly he's a planner, and he knows what he's doing. He's been at the game for a long, long time. So they enter an elevator that scans Peter, says hi to him, and Peter makes a comment about kind of expecting a farm or a commune. You know, they're all sitting around holding hands around the campfire, singing Kumbaya. You know, that, again, that's what he's bringing to the table. Obviously, Harada had never mentioned anything like that. And his guide says, oh, you know, it's the Harbinger Foundation. It's primarily a secret school, and it's deep inside Harada's global conglomerates, and it's a lot different than you might expect. And when they get out of the elevator, you know, they're on the top floor, and you know, it's floor-to-ceiling windows, and again, Pete is kind of surprised by the look and feel of everything, and he's like, how can you keep all this a secret? And the response from Rachel is, well, mind wipes and memory bubbles. It's a lot easier than you think. And Pete, again, he can't help but be impressed. And I suppose that is part of Harada's plan, right? That's the way why these buildings look the way they do. It's no detail is too small for Harada to overlook and make sure that he is giving the right impression, especially to these young kids that he's recruiting, that he's bringing in here. You know, he wants them to drink the Kool-Aid, so to speak. So he wants them to be impressed and overwhelmed, and he wants them to feel like they're part of something greater than themselves. So it does need to look impressive. And Rachel goes on to say that they have buildings like that across the world, and each one is a potential base awaiting activation at a moment's notice if need be, if some catastrophe strikes or Harada deems it time to reveal themselves to the world as Psyots. But one thing that Rachel does say is, now we're in Pittsburgh just for you. They literally set up an entire Harada conglomerate's building there in Pittsburgh, all because of Pete. So it does show how important Harada thinks Pete is to his organization. So as they're walking along, they see the turret drones. And again, Peter's like, man, this is like material grade madness. Like, what's going on with this? And Rachel says, you know, we never profit from war. You know, you've heard of the Toyo, the internet search engine. That's just one of Harada's global conglomerate's revenue streams, but they've got to defend themselves. And when it comes to a turret drone, that's their kind of their last line of defense. And then Rachel says hi to Livewire. This is the first time we're seeing Livewire, and it's a different Livewire, different iteration this go round than the 90s version of Livewire. And she says that Master wishes an audience with the boy. And Rachel says, okay, I'm going to leave you, but I promise that beautiful things will grow from your time here. And Amanda takes Pete into his living quarters, and it's nothing like Pete has ever been able to experience in his life, right? Like, he's been on the run for a long time. Previous to that, he was in a mental hospital, not actually places that you would consider the lap of luxury. So for him, I think Toyo Harada is hoping to kind of wow him, you know, just like the impressiveness of the entryway. It's not an overt bribe. And Toyo does say, well, you know, physical comfort is necessary because we're going to challenge you in other ways. But I think Toyo does believe on some level that he is really kind of bribe Peter, right? Like, show him what's possible, show him what he's never had, show him comfort, show him some luxuries. And he may be able to ingratiate himself with Peter to some extent by showing him those things and giving him access to comforts that he's never had before. And they have a brief conversation. Pete says, I've never lived like this. Seems lonely, you know, having a big room by himself. And then he notices the view. And this is interesting. Harada asks him what he sees out there. And, he's like, Pete says, I'm tired. I'm wiped. I just want to. And so Toyo answers for him. And he says, well, I see a constant struggle for power, right? You see humanity. You see it growing like a weed, hungry for everything, desperate to survive. And so the question becomes, how does one turn a weed into a rose? So again, it's things like that, comparing humanity to a weed, that you got to think, man, this guy is not for the good, right? There's not necessarily something wrong with him, but he's definitely not a glass half full kind of guy. And you already kind of get those overtones of maybe something is not right. He's definitely not a white hat, so to speak. And so Pete's answer is, I don't know, a plague, which maybe is even darker than Harada was thinking about going, and even says that, dark. But no, you do it through centralization, species cohesion, a singular vision that everyone can support. And that's what Harada Global Conglomerates does every day. It's Harada, you know, kind of spelling out his plan and what he tries to do and how he tries to influence the world. And again, it's not all for the good, because he's doing it surreptitiously. If he was doing it out in the open, you might have to have a little more respect for him. But the fact that he's pulling strings behind closed doors, he's taking away people's freedoms. Again, I myself get that feeling of, man, this guy might not be for the good. And he gives Pete the rundown on the largest corporate group in the world, and they fund and operate tech and pharmacy, big pharma, energy corporation, NGOs, endowment groups, and manipulate the economy by hopefully strengthening it and providing jobs and centralized power and information. And again, Toyo Harada mentions the species cohesion. That's what he's looking for. And Pete's a little taken aback. He said, I didn't know I was coming to work for a corporation. And Harada kind of poo-poos that. He's like, it's a culture. It's not a corporation. It's a belief, really. And Pete's not convinced. You know, he's kind of got the same suspicions that I would have in his place. Well, with these powers, it'd be really easy to manipulate markets and build the system. And Harada, there he is, probably not something he's hearing for the first time from people. So he's quick there with the answer, saying, well, if you can build the system, then that means the system doesn't work, right? And that's what we're going to try to fix. And so he takes his leave from Peter, saying, forgive me for keeping you. You need to rest tomorrow. You begin probably the most difficult first day that you've ever had. So Toyo takes his leave. He goes into a very private chamber, telling Amanda to cancel his rounds. He's going to be spending the rest of the night in consultation, and dismisses her. He uses his powers to unlock a very thick door. And behind that door, we have the Bleeding Monk, who we saw in issue one. We hear, we learn from Harada himself that the Bleeding Monk is the greatest living precog in the world. And the Bleeding Monk has told Harada many times the future is not fixed. And so he's asking once again, now that Harada has Pete in his... under his roof, I was going to say in his clutches, but it's probably not to that extent yet, but under his roof, and he has an idea that he's going to be safe. He says, show me again, the future. And the Bleeding Monk says, you're always welcome in my mind, but I'm afraid you'll find the vision has not wavered. And the picture we see is burning buildings, a lot of smoke and wreckage. And the Bleeding Monk says, Peter Stanchek is the great destroyer. And we see Peter flying through the air, eyes alight. The next page, it's the following day. Pete has put on his uniform. He's greeted by Hidden Moon, who is the headmaster of the school. And he mentions that Pete looks good in the uniform, and then asks Pete to follow him 10 steps behind him and address him only as sensei. And Hidden Moon has the power to psionically dampen other people's powers. So that's why he wants Pete to walk behind him, also a sign of respect. And so he starts giving Pete the tour, shows him the library, shows him other students being trained, mentions them needing to be activated. And that intrigues Pete to some extent. He's like, activated? What do you mean activated? And that's when Hidden Moon explains to him that it's a very painful and humbling experience, and Pete didn't have to go through it, and that troubles some of the other students. So he doesn't really explain at that point what it means to be activated or not, Pete still doesn't quite understand. So he explains the different ranks based on how many years a student has trained there and how it's differentiated by the uniforms they wear. And Pete asks what happens when they graduate, and Hidden Moon says, well, then you know, again, it's the hard sell of Harada knows all, is benevolent, and well, yeah, when you graduate, you get to be part of the greatest effort in history of mankind, the unseen hand, as Toyo Harada struggles to craft a better world. Not bothering to ask anybody if they want a better world. You know, it's the world according to Harada. And Pete says, wait, we're in an army for a training for a corporation? What are you telling me? And Hidden Moon says, no, we're far more interesting than that, but we've arrived for your first appointment. And this is the first time Pete meets Ingrid Hillcraft, and she's the kind of the school psychologist, if you will. And Pete's immediately turned off. He's like, you know, been in mental hospitals for the last I don't know how many years. And he mentions, I've dealt a lot with psychiatrists, and, you know, he doesn't want to go down that path again. And Ingrid corrects him and says, well, I'm a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. I'm not one who's going to numb you with meds, but I understand your discomfort. And she asks Pete about communicating telepathically with Harada the previous night. And Pete mentions that he liked it. It was a lot less confusing. And Ingrid, you know, ever polite, asks to be invited into Pete's mind rather than just, you know, barge in. And so they begin communicating telepathically. We also see there's another small boy in the room who's also a telepath, and we learn that that's Darpan, who was the baby that Harada rescued at the beginning of issue 2. And once Pete starts to feel comfortable, Ingrid invites Darpan in, and then they're going to use Darpan's powers. And again, those Darpan, which means the mirror, is going to reflect. It's going to show Pete his worst moments, and it's a way for Ingrid herself to kind of understand where Pete's coming from. And I imagine Harada wants this information both to possibly use as leverage against Pete in the future, but also to understand what the starting point is. What has Pete gone through? What has he been through? And how can Harada use that knowledge to possibly manipulate Pete or get Pete to drink the Kool-Aid? So we get some flashbacks of Pete as a young child being teased by some other children and lashing out at one of them. And Pete says he kind of loses it in present day here. He's like, I changed my mind. I don't want this. Get out of my head. And but Ingrid and Darpan don't stop. We see Christmas when Pete's 11 and he sensed that his father had the ability to have psionic powers and tried to activate him but put him into a coma. And then we see Pete's mother driving him to a hospital, making him promise not to hurt the doctors. And Pete says, I don't want people to be afraid of me anymore. I promise not to use my powers ever. He gets to the hospital. He's going through electric shock. It's very traumatic. And then Ingrid is there beside him in the vision, explaining how Pete shouldn't be angry about the things that he's done because he had powers before he even had the most basic understanding of the world. And it's a burden that very few psiots will understand. Right. And again, this is all about being activated versus not activated. Pete, Toyo Harada, Darpan, born activated. Everybody else has to go through a painful and sometimes deadly process. Not everyone survives it in order to activate their powers. And so it's kind of a six of one, half a dozen of the other, right? Like, what's better? Is it better to have these incredible powers when you're at such a small age that you don't even understand them and you don't know any different than to use them, but you may be careless with them because you don't understand mortality and the consequences of your actions when you're so small? Or is it better to be activated later when you run the risk of that process killing you and it's painful and humbling? And so it's an interesting concept to think about. But Ingrid goes on to say, trying not to use the powers isn't the answer either, because then we're denying who we are as ourselves. Basically, we're not being true to ourselves. And she takes Pete back further with the help of Darpan to when the powers didn't feel like a burden. And we see him young in his crib, and he's using his powers to kind of float, and his toys are floating around the room and the mobile above his crib. And Ingrid says, one last thing before we're done. Did you say you were trying to activate your father's dormant powers? And that really is a possible clue into what the reason is that Harada wants Pete so badly. Because it may be that Pete will be able to activate Psyots more easily than Harada's been able to do it so far through mechanical means, and perhaps have a greater success rate. So when Pete leaves that appointment, Hidden Moon shows up again, and Pete just wants to go back to his room. He's like, I don't feel so good. I want to lie down. And Hidden Moon says, well, you know, on day one, you confront your demons, and your gift will never be easy. And Pete's like, I just went through electroshock therapy. Like, he just relived that, right? I can't even remember your name. I need a sedative or something. And Hidden Moon completely ignores all that and says, what you need is to eat. Luckily, it's lunchtime, the social hour. And when Pete walks into the cafeteria, all of a sudden he's begins to be flooded by everyone else's thoughts and opinions of him. And they're not flattering. I'll just put it that way. And Pete mentions that all of a sudden he can hear everyone's thoughts and he couldn't before. And he tells Hidden Moon, you've done something to me, right? You can keep people from using their powers. And Hidden Moon says, I'm the headmaster. I control everything. And Pete's curious. So why are you letting me hear them now? Well, because it's time you understood what they think of you, which is interesting. It's again, almost the idea that we're going to tear you down in order to build you up. Like it's a classic, you know, it's kind of what they do in military training. And there's some validity to it, but I don't know that Pete, especially in the state of mind he's currently in, it's the best thing for him. And we kind of get an idea of that when Ion shows up, who is the kind of the teaching assistant, if you will, for Hidden Moon. He's the student that's been there the longest, and he comes to introduce himself. And Hidden Moon says, Pete, this is Daniel, senior student at the school, my assistant instructor, code name is Ion. And Pete hears Ion in his mind saying he won't stand, he won't bow, he won't take my hand, he has no concept of respect, we'll have to break him down, you know, just like I was talking about. And as Ion sticks out his hand and says, welcome to the foundation, Pete's response is, I can hear you. And Ion says, I'm sorry. It's like, look, it's been a long day, right? Long 2 days, actually. I hurt some people that I loved, and I got scammed into joining this freak show, relived the worst moments of my life, so maybe you can give me some space and we'll play nice later. And Ion doesn't take to that. Watch your tone. I'm not your friend. I'm not your equal. I'm your senior, one of your instructors, and you will. And I love this. Pete's like, I said piss off, and gives him a mind spike, to which Ion immediately responds by using his powers to manipulate small electrical charges and ozonate the air inside Pete's lungs. So Pete starts gagging. Again, Pete has no training at this point, but he's able to stop this second in command of the students here, as he seems to be a little full of himself, little smirk on his face, saying, you can have powers like this someday if you learn to respect the training and your instructors. And Pete lashes out, says, listen, you chatty tool, you don't know anything about me. And you know who knows their place? You tell me. And then Hidden Moon steps in, turns Pete's powers off, says, enough. And Pete doesn't go in for that either. He's like, you don't get to turn me off. How good at that little trick do you think you are? And Hidden Moon has complete confidence in himself. He says, this sparring session is over and congratulations on your first full-scale psionic exchange. And Pete's like, oh man, first days of school always did suck. And he does not seem to be having a good day. As we turn the page, we're in Richmond, Virginia, and we're watching somebody play some kind of an MMO computer game, talking with someone else within the game. And Hero Girl 08, we learn, is Faith Hebert. And she's talking to somebody on the computer called F.A. Tiger. And this F.A. Tiger expresses a desire to meet her. And she's a little reluctant. She's like, I don't know why anybody like you would want to meet someone like me. And the response from F.A. Tiger is, I came on this site to find a girl just like you. And be honest with me, haven't you always felt a little special, Faith? And we get the little blurb next, you got to have faith. And we'll learn a lot more about Faith in the next issue. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on this issue overall, Jesse?
Well, I think that it's very important tell our listeners that issue three is probably, next to issue one, the most important of issues of the early series. You know, you've got a lot of things going on here that won't fully be realized until later. But this is where you first see the divergence between, you know, what the Harbinger Foundation stands for and does, and Pete, you know, where he, you know, yeah, he's there, but, you know, it's only a matter of seconds now before he starts going in a different direction, which will be the crux of what we call the Harbinger story. So that's one. This is a pivotal point. Two, it's the first appearance of modern Livewire, who, you know, basically for all intents and purposes is the center figure of Unity later on, and gets her own title. It might as well be on par with Ninjak or the Eternal Warrior at this point in time in 2018. But yet, if you were to go back in time and read this issue and see her, you know, bowing early on as one of the senior lieutenants for Toyo Harada, you might not have realized that. You didn't know she was important because she has a, you know, a uniform that's different than everybody else, and, you know, clearly she has access to the leader. But, you know, so that's huge. That's absolutely huge. You're introduced to Ion, who we later see in Imperium. You're introduced briefly in with a cameo to Faith, who is one of the main characters of the Harbinger series, but also later on one of the main characters in the Valiant universe. We see her in so many titles, including her own, you know, several miniseries and an ongoing title at one point. So there's a lot going on in issue three. There's a lot. It's one of those issues that you wouldn't have realized it at the time, but looking back a few years, you can say, wow, that thing is packed. That's a packed issue. You know, it doesn't have a whole bunch of ninja flips or, you know, spaceships exploding, but it does have some fights, does have some drama, it has exposition, and it has an introduction to a lot of concepts and characters that are going to build the Valiant universe.
Yeah, what I really like about it is it establishes, you know, we kind of had an idea already from the first issue and the choices that Pete has been making and does make in terms of what he does to Chris Hathaway, which, you know, we heard Joshua Dysart himself talk about how despicable a move that was, and he questioned whether or not he should have done it. Right away we have an idea of who Pete is. And then we get introduced to Toyo Harada in issue two, and he's, you know, he's saying all the right things. He's saying things that a hero would say, that a leader would say. And then you kind of wonder when Pete decides to go with him, well, okay, so is this a hero story, right? Is this a redemption story? Is Toyo the wise mentor? You know, you could even go so far as to call him an archetype or a stereotype, right? Like, how many Western movies have we seen where some white guy has power or ability, whether that be supernatural or martial arts ability or whatever, and here comes the older Asian mentor to teach him the wise ways of the world and how to use his powers for good, right? So you can, you know, as much as it's a stereotype, you know, there's some truth to that. So you can look at it, if you're coming at it with fresh eyes and you didn't have prior knowledge, like, okay, is that what this story is going to be? Are we going to see Pete go to the Harada Foundation and Toyo's going to work his magic, and, you know, it's for the good of all mankind, and that's what we're going to see, right? That's how the path the story is going to take. That's far too simple for Joshua Dysart. It's much more interesting to come in and not have the black and white lines, right? Toyo Harada is much more complicated of a figure than that. And it's also not like, okay, well, now Pete has been recruited into this foundation, and to take nothing away from these followers of Toyo, you know, to some extent, they've had the wool pulled over their eyes. They're drinking the Kool-Aid, and they believe what they're doing is for the greater good. And, you know, there's a whole branch of philosophy that talks about that. And you got to be willing to, you know, break some eggs in order to make an omelet. But a lot of people aren't going to go in for that. You know, if one person has to die, the price is too high. And again, it's just different perspectives. And what I love about what Joshua does in this issue with Pete is it's not that simple, right? Pete comes in and he's still Pete. He's still the damaged Psyot. and he's not going to take crap from anybody. And it feels much more authentic than to go with an old trope and tell a story that's been told a bunch of times. And actually, this is one of my favorite issues of the early run for exactly that reason, because I much more identify with Pete here than I do with Ion or any of the rest, right? Like you could even look at what Ingrid does to him as a trick too, right? Like he talks about getting scammed into joining the freak show. And then would he possibly have said, yeah, Ingrid, come on into my mind. Let's communicate telepathically, if he knew that Darpan was going to come right along with Ingrid and show him the worst moments of his life? I would think not. Right. And so it's completely understandable when he lashes out at Ion. And again, you also get a glimpse into just how powerful Pete is, because no training, only whatever he's been able to teach himself so far up to this point. And he's taking on one of the most seasoned soldiers, if you will, of the Harada corporation, of Harada's disciples or pupils or whatever you want to call them. So, yeah, there's a lot to unpack here, and even beyond what is obvious, there's so much behind the scenes that you can kind of get an idea of who Pete is as a character. He's still being true to himself, and it's also a really compelling read, because even though we have a lot thrown at us in this third issue in terms of other characters that are being introduced, some more fleshed out than others, everybody has their own little kind of time in the spotlight, even if it's just a panel or two, but it's enough that you get intrigued by it, and then it makes you want to know more, and it turns into a really compelling read. And I'll include in that that last page where we meet Faith for the first time, who, as Jesse said, she ends up becoming a very important character in the Value universe. So let me ask you this, Jesse, do you buy into that whole got to break people down to build them back up kind of philosophy that it seems like that's what Harada does to his students or his potential students? And Ion basically says as much when he meets Pete for the first time.
Well, it's a very nuanced thing that has a lot to do with your biological wiring right off the bat. And also your potential. Not everybody, to be honest, should be broken down. Some people, it's, you know, they have no business stepping foot in the door. And I would argue that Pete would be one of those people, just psychologically. It just so, unfortunately happens that he's like the second most powerful guy on the planet. So as a result of that, you know, he's kind of in a situation where, at least from an investment perspective, Harada kind of is willing to take that risk. Now, if we're talking outside of the Harbinger universe and looking at people as a whole, it depends. There are people that, when they're 18, 19 years old, have not figured out really their direction or their potential or who they are as a person. And they're smart enough intellectually to rationalize a number of behaviors and things that, you know, they'll argue any point. They'll go in circles. They won't take responsibility for their own actions or emotions or beliefs or whatever the case may be. Until they're placed in a situation where there's boundaries and definitive black and white, that's right and wrong and whatnot, and then all of a sudden it changes how they operate. Now this can be good and bad depending on what the desired outcome is. I know for myself, it was actually a very good thing, because instead of getting stuck in these circular debates and rationalizations with behavior, it was all of a sudden I was like, "Oh, I need to know this is the right way to go. I'm gonna make a definitive choice and move in this direction. I'm gonna own it." And then I was able to move forward with my existence in my life. Whereas I felt like I was kind of like spinning my wheels in my early 20s. However, I have seen a number of people over the last 20 years that, you break them down and they just kind of stay broken down because they were never meant to be there in the first place. So to answer the question, it really depends on the individual. Now, when you have a situation where, you know, you have to get a lot of people geared up real quick to deal with a global or, massive threat to humanity, well, we don't really have time to do anything but break people down and get them going real quick. But when you do have time and you do have a lot of options, well, you have options and you have to reassess, the approach. I understand from Harada's perspective why he's doing what he's doing. That said, it is a little bit, evil in this story, because deep down they know what they're doing to Pete, and it is a bit of a mind trick. Now, would it be better if, for humanity, if he were to get on board and him and Toyo were to move stride for stride and change the world? Possibly. Actually, probably. But that also gets into the story of free will and a number of other things that, are the core of what makes a human being a human being. And actually, in the end, it's the crux of what makes the story Harbinger what it is.
Yeah, and the other thing to really think about on this issue is the glimpse that we get of the Bleeding Monk and what he sees as the future and what Toyo Harada sees as the future when he looks inside the Bleeding Monk's mind, right? Like, he sees the future. He sees Peter Stanchek become the Great Destroyer. What exactly that means at this point, we don't completely understand, but it's something that Toyo doesn't want to come to pass. And so then you start getting into the whole idea of, can the future be changed? Could what Toyo is doing now actually be somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy? There's that whole idea that the future is not set in stone, and so it can be changed. And there's the other side, the people that believe, well, no, the future is what it is. You can't change it no matter what, as opposed to the people that believe, well, it can be changed. And by making yourself, even by making yourself aware, by learning about the future, you're already changing it, right? You can think of it like Schrodinger's cat. Purely by observing it, you're affecting it. So clearly,
right. And you look at it from Toyo's perspective, he might think by taking no action with Pete that Pete will become the Great Destroyer. Or it could be that by taking action with Pete becomes the Great Destroyer. He knows what the Bleeding Monk is telling him, but at the same time, he questions it, and he challenges it, but he also tries to interpret it. He also tries to, gamble with it. And that roll of the dice is a dangerous thing because, it's everything you've said there, Jace. It may become a self-fulfilling prophecy, or, he may be willing to take that risk where he feels that he's averted, the dystopian evil future for Pete by interfering with Pete.
But see, here's the thing about Toyo, right? And it's, to me, it's his fatal flaw, maybe his biggest weakness, however you want to label it. I don't think that he has, I think his ego is so big, his confidence and his self-confidence, his belief in himself has so, and rightly so, with what he's been able to accomplish up to this point in his life, he has the, extreme belief in himself, complete confidence that he knows what he's doing. And so I don't know that he can logically or personally make an objective decision, step back from the situation and realize that sometimes things can't be changed. Sometimes no matter what you being Toyo Harada, no matter how powerful you are, you're just not going to be able to make the change you want to make. And Pete is, for whatever reason, destined to be the Great Destroyer, whatever that means. I don't think at this point in his life that Toyo's able to accept the fact that he might not be able to change that. And so I think regardless of whether it's a self-fulfilling prophecy or not, he can't help himself but to get in there, get his hands on Pete, and start trying to manipulate and control Pete so that what he sees in the vision doesn't come to pass, regardless of whether that's a self-fulfilling prophecy or not. I don't think he's able to see that. I don't think he's able to accept that because he's been able to this point, pretty much achieve anything he set his mind to, right?
For the most part, yes. And there is some arrogance that comes along with success. Now, at the same time, through most of human history, elders were revered for their wisdom and experience by the younger generation, and the concept of mentorship and having like a guide in life was one that is not foreign. I mean, it's something that, you know, it existed in Japan and China and throughout much of the world, because even the most badass 18-year-old guy doesn't really know all the things that, a battle hardened and seasoned and experienced 50-year-old man might. And so what's interesting though is that in Western civilization, this concept has never really caught on very well. In Western civilization, and mostly Western Europe and the Americas in particular, we have a tendency to look at old age as obsolete. You know, oh, get out of my way, old man. Oh, shut up, old man. You don't know what you're talking. I'm so much smarter. I grew up with the internet. You know, and so we have a rebellious nature about it. And you see it a lot, especially in my line of work. You guys, you just watch them in slow motion walking into pitfalls left and right. And you're like scratching your head like, God, man, if you guys would just listen to me, it'd probably be like amazing. But sure enough, you know, there he goes into another pitfall. Oh, look at that. He just married a stripper. Who knew? Oh, look at that. The guy didn't invest his money. Oh, look at that. And so in this situation, you got a very, very, yes, arrogant, but very, very, strong visionary in Toyo Harada who sees so much potential and value in Pete, and Pete is just not that guy. Pete has the powers, he has potential, but the reality is he's got a lot of flaws, and some of those are just who he is. Some of those are his upbringing, and some of those are a result of having the powers he's had and not knowing how to deal with it. You mentioned earlier, is it better to have powers early on or to work for them later on? I think it's better to work for them later on because you understand how to value them. You understand, you have a little bit of fear to it, a little bit of caution to it. You understand the cause and effect to it and the responsibility that comes with it. Whereas I've seen people, even athletes that were born as natural athletes that are defeated by people time and time again who had to work a little bit more. Because they had more drive, they had more concern, they had more passion for it. It's really interesting. I think that Pete is unfortunately one of those characters that I've seen in my life where they're just not designed on so many levels to be a leader. They're not designed to really be in the position that they're unfortunately thrust into. And unfortunately, you can't really train somebody to be a leader. You can train a person who already has the traits of a leader to be a better leader, absolutely. But some people are just kind of like just the wrong people.
Yeah, and whether or not Pete can be a leader, whether or not he can gain that wisdom is kind of what the point of the series really is all about. But what really struck me about this issue 3, because again, I so identify with Pete and his reactions in this issue, and it really made me think about what Joshua Dysart said when we had him on about the fact that he really had another ending in mind, another story to tell about Pete to really bring it full circle with that story of redemption for him. And it's really too bad that story is going to go untold, because just based on how far he's taken Pete in just a couple of short issues. He really seems to have such a great understanding for the character, and really makes him both empathetic in a way. I think a lot of us can relate to Pete really easily, but also, you know, we can't help but look at him and shake our heads and think, man, how could you do the things that you've done, you know, especially in regards to what he did with Chris. So again, I just think Josh is a great writer, and I would have loved to have gotten his full character arc for Pete, because I think that ultimately, although you may never be able to forget what Pete did to Chris, and to some extent, you may never be able to fully forgive him, you still can watch him become a hero that spends the rest of his life trying to atone for that and really becoming a force for good in the Valiant universe. And I feel like the Valiant universe could really use that, right? Use that that one singular hero that you really look to as like the symbol for hope, you know, kind of like Superman is for DC, or Captain Marvel is, or Captain America rather is over at Marvel Comics. To have Pete be that symbol that the rest of the heroes look up to, it's something I think that the Valiant universe is lacking a little bit. So,
That's really the tragedy. That's really the tragedy of Valiant right now, is that really in the 90s, we never got to see the full arc, really, really full arc for Pete, because, you know, of course, the claim bought him out, and it just didn't end. It didn't end as it might otherwise have done. And we didn't get to see that in modern Valiant, really, because you know, of the state of Valiant, where it went, and also Dysart stepping away. And so it really is a tragedy that in almost 30 years, you know, of being a Valiant fan, you know, I've never really been able to see what Pete could be.
Yeah, and I think at some point that's a story that not only deserves to be told, but really needs to be told. All right, anything else we want to say about this issue, Jesse? I feel like we've pretty much said it all at this point.
No, it's definitely one to get your hands on, I think. I think that if, you know, if I was going to collect a comic in physical form, I would definitely want to have a couple copies of this one, because it's significant. You know, again, it's the first modern appearance of Livewire as we know her. It's first modern appearance of Faith as we know her. In a time where we're looking for characters that are diverse and varied and strong and strong female leads, it's hard, especially in the Valiant universe, to find two women that are more iconic and more valuable to the universe than those two, or at least in terms of impact to the Valiant universe. And it all started really with Harbinger issue 3.
Yeah, I completely agree. So once again, Jesse and I want to thank everybody for joining us. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platforms you use. The ratings really help with the visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, be sure to check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.